I knew you'd come for us one day.
I pull away before she can figure out that I'm not who I said I was.
Of course,
I lie.
We're a family. You must come inside. Grace will be back soon, and we can visit in the meantime.
I'd like that, I say. Serenity and I follow Nevi inside. Not a single window in the house is open, and there is no air circulation. I wonder if I could trouble you for a glass of water, I ask.
No trouble at all, Nevi says.
She leads me into a living room, a big space with a vaulted ceiling and several couches and tables covered with white sheets. One couch has had its protective cover removed. Serenity sits on it while I peek under the sheets, trying to find a desk, a filing cabinet, any sort of information to explain this turn of events.
What the holy hell is happening?
Serenity hisses at me as soon as Nevi shuffles into the kitchen.
Grace will be back soon? I thought she was dead. I thought Nevi was trampled.
I thought that too, I admit. I saw a body, that's for sure.
Was it hers?
But that I can't answer. When I had reached the scene, Gideon was cradling the victim in his lap. I remember the skull split like a melon, the hair shampooed with blood. But I don't know if I ever actually got close enough to see the face. Even if I had, I wouldn't have been able to say it was Nevi Rule, since I'd never even seen a picture of her. I trusted Thomas when he named the victim, because he would have recognized his own employee.
Who called the police that night?
Serenity asks.
Thomas. So maybe he was the one who wanted you to believe Nevi was dead.
But I shake my head.
If Thomas had been the one to go after her in the enclosure, she'd be a lot more nervous than she is right now. And she certainly wouldn't have invited us into her house. Unless she is planning to poison us. Then don't drink the water,
I suggest.
Gideon was the one who found the body. So either he made a mistake, which I don't buy, or he wanted people to think it was Nevi. Well, she didn't just get up from the autopsy table,
Serenity says. I meet her gaze, and I don't have to say anything else. One victim had been taken away that night in a body bag. One victim had been found unconscious, with a blow to the head that maybe could even have resulted in latent blindness, and had been taken to the hospital. Just then, Nevi comes into the room, carrying a tray with a pitcher of water and two glasses. Let me help, I say, taking them from her hands and setting them down on top of a covered coffee table. I pick up the pitcher and pour a glass for each of us. There is a clock somewhere. I can hear the ticking, even if I cannot see it. It's probably rotting away underneath one of the sheets. It's like the whole room is filled with the ghosts of former furniture. How long have you lived here? I ask her.
I've lost track now. Grace was the one who took care of me, you know, after the accident. I don't know what I would have done without her.
Accident?
You know, that night at the sanctuary, the one where I lost my sight. I suppose after hitting my head like that, it could have been much worse. I'm lucky, or so they say.
She sinks down, oblivious to the sheet that covers the wing chair.
I don't remember any of it, which is probably a blessing. When Grace gets here, she can explain everything.
She glances in my direction.
I never blamed you or Mara, Thomas. I hope you know that. Who's Mara?
Serenity pipes up. Until this moment, she hasn't spoken in Nevi's presence. Nevi turns, a hesitant smile playing over her lips.
How rude of me. I didn't realize you brought a guest.
I look at Serenity, panicked. I have to introduce her in a way that follows the fiction I've created, where I am impersonating Thomas Metcalf.
No, I'm the one who's been rude, I say. Do you remember my wife, Alice?
The glass slides out of Nevi's hand, shattering on the floor. I kneel to mop up the water, using one of the sheets covering the furniture. But I am not mopping fast enough. The water soaks through the sheet, and the puddle widens. The knees of my jeans are drenched, and the spill has swelled into a pool. It covers Nevi's feet in her mismatched shoes. Serenity cranes her neck to look around the room.
Sweet Jesus!
The wallpaper is weeping. Water trickles from the ceiling. I glance at Nevi and find her leaning back in her chair, her hands gripping the armrests, her face wet with her own tears and the sobs of this house. I can't move. I can't explain what the hell is happening. Overhead, I watch a crack form in the center of the ceiling and spread as if it is only a matter of time before the plaster gives way. Serenity grabs my arm.
Run!
She shouts, and I follow her out of the house. My shoes splash in puddles that have pooled on the hardwood floors. We don't stop until we are back at the curb, panting.
I think I lost my goddamn weave,
Serenity says, patting the back of her head. Her pink hair, soaked, makes me think of the bloody skull of the victim at the elephant sanctuary. I lean down, still gasping for air. The house on the hill looks just as ramshackle and uninviting as it did when we first arrived. The only evidence of our visit is the damp, frantic trail of footprints on the path, tracks that are rapidly vanishing in the heat, as if we were never there at all.
Alice. 2 months is a long time to be gone. A lot can happen in 2 months. I didn't know where Thomas was, and I wasn't sure I wanted to find out. I didn't know if he was coming back, but he hadn't just left Jenna and me. He had left 7 elephants and a sanctuary staff, which meant that someone needed to take over the business. In 2 months, you can start to feel confident again. In 2 months, you might discover that, in addition to being a scientist, you are also a very good businesswoman. In 2 months, a child can start talking up a storm, cobbled sentences and twisted syllables, naming the world that looks just as new to her as it does to you. In 2 months, you can start over. Gideon had become my right-hand man. Although we talked about hiring a new employee, we didn't have the money for it. We could do this, he assured me. If I could balance my research with the more cerebral, financial work, he could be the brawn. Because of this, he was often working an 18-hour day. One evening, after dinner, I picked up Jenna and wandered out to the point on the property where he was trying to mend a fence. I reached for a pair of pliers and went to work beside him.
You don't have to do that, he told me.
Neither do you, I said. It became a routine. After 6 o'clock, we would work in tandem at whatever was still left on the endless to-do list. We took Jenna with us, and she would collect flowers and chase the wild rabbits that ran through the tall grass. Somehow, we fell into that habit. Somehow, we fell. Mora and Hester were together again in the African enclosure. They had begun to bond and were rarely seen apart. Mora was definitely in charge. When she challenged Hester, the younger elephant would turn around, presenting her bottom, a sign of subordinance. I had witnessed Mora returning to the gravesite of her calf only once since our evening in the swimming pond. She had managed to compartmentalize her grief, to move on. I took Jenna with me every day to observe the elephants, even though I knew Thomas thought it was dangerous. He was not here. He no longer got a vote. My toddler was a natural scientist. She would move around the enclosures, collecting rocks and grasses and wildflowers, and would sort them into piles. Most of these afternoons, Gideon found some work in our vicinity so that he could sit down and rest with us for a little while. I started to bring an extra snack for him, more iced tea. Gideon and I talked about Botswana, about the elephants I had known there, and how they were so different from the animals here. We talked about the stories he'd heard from the keepers who traveled with the elephants when they arrived at the sanctuary, of animals being beaten or stuffed into a chute while being trained.
One day, he was telling me about Lily, the elephant whose leg had never set properly after breaking.
She was in a different circus before that, Gideon said. The ship she was traveling on was docked in Nova Scotia when it caught on fire. It sank. Some of the animals on it were killed. Lily made it out alive, but with second-degree burns on her back and her legs.
Lily, who I'd been taking care of now for nearly 2 years, had been hurt even more than I'd imagined. "It's amazing," I said, "how they don't blame us for what other people did to them."
"I think they forgive."
Gideon looked at Mora, his mouth turning down at the corners.
"I hope they forgive. Do you think she remembers me taking the baby away?"
"Yes," I said bluntly. "But she doesn't hold it against you anymore." Gideon looked like he was about to respond, but suddenly his face froze, and he leaped up and started running. Jenna, who knew better than to stray close to the elephants, who had never tested her limits before, was standing 2 feet away from Mora, staring up at her in a trance. She looked at me, smiling.
"Elephant," she announced.
Mora reached out her trunk, huffing over Jenna's very fine pigtails. It was a moment of magic and of supreme danger. Children and elephants are unpredictable. One sudden move and Jenna could have been trampled. I rose, my mouth dry. Gideon was already there, moving slowly so as not to startle Mora into action. He scooped Jenna into his arms as if this were a game.
"Let's get you back to your mama," he said,
and he looked over his shoulder at Mora. That's when Jenna started to scream.
"Elephant," she yelled. "I want."
She kicked against Gideon's abdomen and squirmed like a fish on the line. It was a full-blown tantrum. The noise startled Mora, who bolted into the woods, trumpeting.
"Jenna," I snapped. "You don't go near the animals. You know better than that."
But the fear in my voice only made her cry harder. Gideon grunted as one of her little sneakers connected with his groin.
"I'm so sorry," I said, reaching for her. But Gideon turned away.
He kept rocking Jenna, bouncing her in his arms, until her screams thinned and her sobs became hiccups. She grabbed the collar of his red uniform shirt in her fist and started to rub the corner of it against her cheek, the way she did with her blanket when she was falling asleep. A few minutes later, he laid my dozing child down at my feet. Jenna's cheeks were flushed, her lips parted. I crouched beside her. She might have been made of porcelain, of moonlight.
"She was overtired," I said.
"She was terrified," Gideon corrected, sitting down beside me again. "After the fact."
"Well," I looked up at him. "Thank you." He stared off into the trees where Mora had vanished.
"Did she run off?"
I nodded. "She was terrified after the fact, too," I said. "Do you know that in all the years I've been doing research, I've never seen an elephant mother lose her temper with a baby? No matter how annoying or whiny or difficult the baby's being?" I reached out to pull a ribbon out of Jenna's hair, which was trailing like an afterthought in the wake of her outburst. Unfortunately, I don't seem to have the same skill set in my parenting.
"Jenna's lucky to have you,"
I smirked. "Considering I'm all she's got."
"No," Gideon said. "I watch you when you're with her. You're a good mother."
I shrugged, waiting for the self-deprecating joke to come, but the words, the validation, meant too much to me. Instead, I heard myself say, "You'd be a good father, too."
He picked up one of the dandelions Jenna had yanked out of the ground and stockpiled before she wandered over toward Mora. He carved a slit in its stem with his thumb and threaded a second through the first.
I sort of thought I would be one by now.
I pressed my lips together because Grace's secret wasn't mine to give. Gideon continued to string the weeds together.
Do you ever wonder if you fall for a person? Or just the idea of her?
What I think is that there is no perspective in grief or in love. How can there be? When one person becomes the center of the universe, either because he has been lost or because he has been found. Gideon took the crown of daisies and slipped it over Jenna's head. It tipped sideways on the knob of one pigtail, falling over her brow. In her sleep, she stirred. Sometimes I think there's no such thing as falling in love. It's just the fear of losing someone. There was a breeze, carrying the scent of wild apples and timothy grass, the earthy smell of elephant hide and manure, the juice of the peach that Jenna had eaten earlier and that had dripped onto her sundress.
Do you worry?
Gideon asked.
About what will happen if he doesn't come back?
It was the first time, really, that we had talked about Thomas leaving. Although we had shared stories of how we met our spouses, that was where the conversation had stayed, at the highest peak of potential, at the moment in those relationships when everything still seemed possible. Lifting my chin, I looked squarely at Gideon. I worry about what will happen if he does, I said. It was colic. It was not uncommon in elephants, especially ones who had been given bad hay or whose diet had been radically and quickly changed. Neither of those was the case for Sira, but still she lay on her side, drowsy, bloated. She wouldn't eat or drink. Her stomach growled. Gertie, the dog who was her constant companion, sat at her side and howled. Grace was at my cottage babysitting for Jenna. She'd stay there all night so that we could watch over the elephant. Gideon had volunteered, but I was in charge now. There was no way I couldn't be there too. We stood in the barn with our arms crossed, watching the vet examine the elephant.
He's just going to tell us what we already know,
Gideon whispered to me. Yeah, and then he's going to give her drugs to make her better. He shook his head.
What do you plan to pawn to pay his bill?
Gideon was right about that. Money was so tight right now that we had to borrow from our operating expenses if we were going to cover the cost of emergencies like this one. I'll figure it out, I said, scowling. We watched the vet give Sira an anti-inflammatory, Flunixin, and a muscle relaxant. Gertie curled up beside her in the hay, whimpering.
All we can really do is wait and hope she starts passing boluses, he said. In the meantime, get her to drink some water.
But Sira didn't want to drink. Every time we came near her with a bucket, whether it was heated or cooled, she huffed and tried to turn her head away. After several hours of this, Gideon and I were both emotionally wrecked. Whatever the vet had administered did not seem to be working. It is a pitiful thing seeing such a strong and majestic animal laid low. It made me think of the elephants in the bush I'd seen who had been shot by villagers or injured by snares. I knew, too, that colic wasn't something to be taken lightly. It could lead to impaction, and that could lead to death. I knelt beside Sira, palpating her, feeling the tightness of her abdomen. Has this happened before?
Not to Sira, he said. But it's not the first time I've seen it.
He seemed to be chewing on a thought, equivocating. Then he looked at me.
Do you use baby oil on Jenna's skin.
I used to put it in the bath, I said. Why?
Where is it?
If I still have any, it would be under the sink in the bathroom.
He stood up and walked out of the barn.
Where are you going?
I called, but I couldn't follow him. I wouldn't leave Sierra.
10 minutes later, Gideon returned. He was holding 2 bottles of baby oil and a Sara Lee pound cake I recognized from my own refrigerator. I followed him into the kitchen of the Asian barn, where we prepared meals for the elephants. He started to unwrap the cake's packaging. I'm not hungry, I told him.
This isn't for you.
Gideon set the cake on the counter and began to stab it with a knife, repeatedly. I think it's dead, I said. He opened a bottle of baby oil and poured it over the cake. The fluid began to sink into the sponge, settling into the puncture marks he'd made.
At the circus, the elephants colicked sometimes. The vet used to tell us to get them to drink oil. I guess it gets things moving.
The vet didn't say,
Alice.
Gideon hesitated, his hands stilling over the cake.
Do you trust me?
I looked at this man, who had worked by my side for weeks now to create the illusion that this sanctuary could survive, who had saved me once, and my daughter. I read once, in a silly women's magazine at the dentist, that when we like someone, our pupils dilate, and that we tend to like people whose pupils are dilated when they look at us. It's an endless cycle. We want the people who want us. Gideon's irises were nearly the same color as his pupils, which created an optical illusion, a black hole, an endless fall. I wondered what mine looked like in response. Yes, I said. He instructed me to get a bucket of water, and I followed him into the stall where Sierra still lay on her side, her belly rising and falling with effort. Gertie sat up, suddenly alert.
Hey, beautiful,
Gideon said, kneeling in front of the elephant. He held out the cake.
Sierra, she's got a real sweet tooth, he told me.
She sniffed the cake with her trunk. She touched it gingerly. Gideon broke off a small piece and tossed it into Sierra's mouth while Gertie sniffed at his fingers. A moment later, Sierra took the entire cake and swallowed it whole.
Water,
Gideon said. I settled the bucket where Sierra could reach and watched her siphon out a trunkful. Gideon leaned in, his strong hands stroking her flank, telling her what a good girl she was. I wished he would touch me like that. The thought came so fast that I fell back on my heels. I have to go check on Jenna, I stammered. Gideon glanced up.
I'm sure she and Grace are both asleep.
I have to... My voice trailed off. My face was hot. I pressed my palms against my cheeks. Turning, I hurried out of the barn. Gideon was right. When I reached the cottage, Grace and Jenna were curled together on the couch. Jenna's hand was caught in Grace's. It made me feel sick to know that while Grace had been taking care of someone I loved, I had been wishing I could do the same with someone she loved. She stirred, careful to sit up without waking Jenna. Is it Sierra? What happened? I gathered Jenna into my arms. She woke up briefly before her eyes drifted shut again. I didn't want to disturb her, but it was more important in that moment to remember who I was, what I was, a mother, a wife. You should tell him, I said to Grace, about not being able to have a baby. She narrowed her eyes. We had not discussed this since first broaching the topic weeks ago. I knew she was worried that maybe I had already said something to Gideon, but that wasn't it at all. I wanted them to have that conversation so Gideon would know Grace trusted him wholly. I wanted them to have that conversation so they could make plans for a future that included surrogacy or adoption. I wanted the bond between them to be so strong that I could not, even accidentally, find a chink in the wall of their marriage through which I could peek. You should tell him, I repeated, because he deserves to know. The next morning, two wonderful things happened. Sierra got up, seemingly over her colic, and wandered with a bouncing Gertie into the Asian enclosure. And the fire department dropped off a gift, a used fire hose that they wanted to donate since they'd recently upgraded their equipment. Gideon, who had gotten even less sleep than I had, seemed to be in a terrific mood. If Grace had taken my advice and spoken to him about her secret, he either had taken it well or was too happy about Sierra's recovery to let the news affect him. At any rate, he certainly didn't seem to be thinking twice about my awkward exit the night before. He hefted the hose over his shoulder.
"The girls are going to love this," he said, grinning. "Let's test it out."
"I have a million things to do," I replied, "and so do you." I was being a bitch, but if that created a wall between us, that was safer. The vet returned to examine Sierra and gave her a clean bill of health. I buried myself in the office, checking accounts, trying to figure out where I could borrow from Peter to pay Paul so that the vet's bill would be covered. Jenna sat at my feet, coloring the photos in old newspapers with her crayons. Nevi had taken one of the trucks into town for a tune-up, and Grace was cleaning out the African barn. It wasn't until Jenna tugged on my shorts and told me she was hungry that I realized hours had passed. I made her peanut butter and jelly, cutting the sandwich into squares just the right size for her hands. I took off the crusts, saving them in my pocket for Mora. And then I heard the sound of someone dying. Grabbing Jenna, I started to run toward the African barn, where the sounds were coming from. I had a series of concussive, thunderous thoughts. Mora and Hester are fighting. Mora is injured. One of the elephants has hurt Grace. One of the elephants has hurt Gideon. I threw open the barn door to find Hester and Mora in their stalls, with the retractable bars that separated the two wide open. In this big expanse, they were frolicking, dancing, chortling in the artificial rain of the fire hose. As Gideon sprayed them, they turned in circles and squealed. They weren't dying. They were having the time of their lives.
"What are you doing?"
I yelled, as Jenna kicked to get out of my arms. I set her on the ground, and she immediately began to jump in puddles on the cement. Gideon grinned, waving the fire hose through the bars, back and forth.
"Enrichment," he said. "Look at Mora. Have you ever seen her acting crazy like this?"
He was right. Mora seemed to have lost all vestiges of grief. She was shaking her head and stomping in the spray, throwing her trunk up every time she sang out.
"Is the furnace fixed?"
I asked.
"And the oil changed in the ATV? Have you taken down the fence in the African enclosure or stumped the northwest field? Did you regrade the slope of the pond in the Asian enclosure?"
It was a laundry list of all the things we needed to do. Gideon twisted the nozzle of the hose so that the water slowed to a trickle. The elephants trumpeted and turned, waiting for more, hoping. "That's what I thought," I said.
"Jenna, honey, come on."
I started toward her, but she ran away from me, splashing in another puddle. Gideon's mouth flattened.
"Hey, boss," he said,
and he waited for me to turn. As soon as I did, he twisted the nozzle so that the spray hit me square in the chest. It was frigid and shocking, so forceful that I staggered backward, pushing my sopping hair out of my face and looking down at my drenched clothing. Gideon angled the hose so that it struck the elephants instead. He grinned.
"You need to chill out," he said.
I lunged for the hose. He was bigger than me, but I was faster. I turned the spray on Gideon until he held his hands up in front of his face.
"Okay," he laughed, choking on the stream. "Okay, I give up."
"You started it," I reminded him, as his hands tried to wrestle the nozzle away from me. The hose wriggled like a snake between us, and we were faith healers, fighting for a moment of the divine. Slippery, soaked, Gideon finally managed to wrap his arms around me, trapping my hands between us so that the spray hit our feet and I couldn't hold the nozzle anymore. It fell to the ground, swiveling in a semicircle, before it came to rest, spraying a fountain toward the elephants. I was laughing so hard I was out of breath.
"Okay, you win. Let me go," I gasped.
I was temporarily blinded. My hair was plastered to my face. Gideon pushed it away so that I could see him smiling. His teeth, they were impossibly white. I couldn't take my eyes off his mouth.
"I don't think so," he said,
and he kissed me. The shock was even more intense than that first blast of the hose. I froze. For only a heartbeat. And then my arms were around his waist, my palms hot against the damp skin of his back. I ran my hands over the landscape of his arms, the valleys where the muscles joined together. I drank from him like I'd never seen a well this deep.
"Wet,"
Jenna said.
"Mama, wet."
She stood beneath us, one hand patting each of our legs. Until that moment, I had completely forgotten about her. As if I didn't have enough to be ashamed of. For the second time, I ran away from Gideon as if my life were being threatened. Which, I guess, was the truth. For the next 2 weeks, I avoided Gideon, relaying messages instead through Grace or Nevi, making sure I was not alone with him in a barn or enclosure at any time. I left him notes in the kitchens of the barns, lists of what needed to be done. Instead of meeting up with Gideon at the end of the day, I sat with Jenna on the floor of the cottage, playing with puzzles and blocks and stuffed animals. One night, Gideon radioed from the hay barn.
"Dr. Metcalf," he said. "We have a situation."
I could not remember the last time he had referred to me as Dr. Metcalf. Either this was a reaction to the coldness I'd been sending out in waves, or there was a true and urgent problem. I settled Jenna between my legs on the ATV and drove past the Asian barn, where I knew Grace would be preparing the evening meals. "Can you watch her?" I asked. "Gideon said it was urgent." Grace reached for a bucket, turning it over to make a step stool.
"Come on up here, Pumpkin," she said. "See those apples? Can you hand them to me, one at a time?"
She glanced over her shoulder at me.
"We're fine," she said.
I drove up to the hay barn to find Gideon in a standoff with Clyde, who supplied our bales. Clyde was a guy we trusted. Too often, farmers tried to unload their moldy hay on us because they figured it was just elephants, so what was the difference? He had his arms folded across his chest. Gideon stood with one foot braced on a hay bale. Only half the load had been moved into storage from Clyde's truck. "What's the problem?" I asked.
"Clyde says he won't take a check because the last one bounced. but I can't seem to find any of the spare cash. And until I do, Clyde isn't inclined to let me unload the rest of the bales, Gideon said. So maybe you've got a solution.
The reason the last check bounced was that we didn't have any money. The reason there was no spare cash was that I'd used it to pay for produce this week. If I wrote another check, this one would bounce too. I had used the last of the funds in our account to pay the vet's bill. I didn't know how I was going to pay for groceries for my daughter next week, much less hay for the elephants. Clyde, I said, we're going through a rough patch.
So's the whole country.
But we have a relationship, I replied. You and my husband have been in business together for years, right?
Yeah, and he always managed to pay me.
He frowned.
I can't let you have the hay for nothing.
I know. And I can't let the elephants starve. I felt like I was in quicksand. Slowly but surely, I was bound to drown. What I needed to do was fundraise, but I barely had time for it. My research had been long forgotten. I hadn't touched it in weeks. I could barely stay ahead of operations without trying to gauge the interest of new donors. Interest. I looked at Clyde. I'll pay you 10% more if you give me the hay now and let me settle with you next month.
Why would I do that?
Because whether or not you want to admit it, Clyde, we have a history, and you owe us the benefit of the doubt. He didn't owe us anything, but I was hoping the guilt of being the straw that broke the sanctuary's back would be enough to make him pretend otherwise.
20%,
Clyde bargained. I shook his hand. Then I climbed into the truck and began to haul the hay bales. An hour later, Clyde drove away, and I sat down on the edge of a bale. Gideon was still working, his back flexing as he stacked the bales for more efficient storage, lifting them higher than I physically could manage. So, I said, you're just going to pretend I'm not here? Gideon didn't turn around.
Guess I learned from a master.
What was I supposed to do, Gideon? Do you have the answer? Because believe me, I want to hear it. He faced me, his hands resting lightly on his hips. He was sweating. Bits of chaff and straw were caught on his forearms.
I'm sick of being your fall guy. Return the orchids. Get hay for free. Turn fucking water into wine. What's next, Alice?
Should I not have paid the vet then, when Ciro was sick?
I don't know, he said brusquely. I don't care.
He pushed past me as I stood up. Yes, you do, I called, running after him, wiping my hand across my eyes. I didn't ask for any of this, you know. I didn't want to run a sanctuary. I didn't want to worry about sick animals and paying salaries and going bankrupt. Gideon stopped in the doorway. His silhouette was framed by the light as he turned.
So what do you want, Alice?
When was the last time anyone asked me that? I want to be a scientist, I said. I want to make people see how much elephants can think and can feel. He walked forward, filling my field of vision.
And?
I want Jenna to be happy. Gideon took one more step. He was so close now that his question drew across the bow of my neck, making my skin sing.
And?
I had stood my ground before a charging elephant. I had risked my scientific credibility to follow my gut instinct. I had packed up my life and started over. But looking into Gideon's face and telling the truth was the most courageous thing I had ever done. I want to be happy, too, I whispered.
Then we were tumbling over the uneven steps of the hay bales into a nest of straw on the floor of the barn. Gideon's hands were in my hair and under my clothes. My gasp became his next breath. Our bodies were landscapes, maps burned into our palms where we touched. When he moved in me, I knew why. Now we would always find our way back home. Afterward, with hay scratching my back and my clothes tangled around my limbs, I started to speak.
"Don't," Gideon said, touching his fingers to my lips. "Just don't."
He rolled onto his back. My head lay pillowed on his arm at a pulse point. I could feel every beat of his heart.
"When I was little," he told me, "my uncle got me a Star Wars figurine. It was signed by George Lucas, still in the box. I was, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7. My uncle told me not to take it out of the packaging. That way one day it would be worth something."
I tilted my chin so I could look at him. "Did you take it out of the packaging?"
"Shit, yeah."
I burst out laughing. "I thought you were going to tell me you had it on a shelf somewhere, and that you were willing to use it to pay for the hay."
"Sorry, I was a kid. What kid plays with a toy in a box?"
His smile faded a little.
"So I slipped it out of the box in a way that no one would notice if they didn't look too closely. I played with that Luke Skywalker figure every day. I mean, it went to school with me, into the bathtub. It slept next to me. I loved that thing. And yeah, it might not have been as valuable that way, but it meant the world to me."
I knew what he was saying. That the untouched collector's item might have been worth something, but all those stolen moments were priceless. Gideon grinned.
"I'm really glad I took you off the shelf, Alice."
I punched him in the arm. "You make me sound like a wallflower."
"If the shoe fits."
I rolled on top of him. "Stop talking." He kissed me.
"I thought you'd never ask," he said,
and his arms closed around me again. The stars squinted at us by the time we walked out of the barn. There was still straw in my hair and dirt on my legs. Gideon didn't look much better. He climbed on the ATV and I sat behind him, my cheek pressed against his back. I could smell myself on his skin.
"What do we say?" I asked.
He looked over his shoulder.
"We don't,"
he replied, and he started the engine. Gideon stopped at his cottage first, getting off the ATV. The lights were out. Grace was still with Jenna. He did not risk touching me there, out in the open, but he stared at me.
"Tomorrow?"
he asked. That could have meant anything. We could have been arranging a time to move the elephants, to clean the barn, to change the spark plugs on the truck. But what he was really asking was if I would go back to avoiding him the way I did before, if this would happen again. "Tomorrow," I repeated. A minute later, I reached my own cottage. I parked the ATV and climbed off, trying to straighten the nest of my hair and to brush off my clothes. Grace knew I had been up at the hay barn, but I didn't just look like I'd been unloading bales. I looked like I'd been through a war. I rubbed my hand over my mouth, wiping away Gideon's kiss, leaving only excuses. When I opened the door, Grace was in the living room. So was Jenna, and holding her with a smile on his face that could light up a galaxy, was Thomas. Spying me, he passed our daughter to Grace and reached for a package on the coffee table. Then he came closer, his eyes wide and clear. He handed me an overturned plant with its gnarled roots serving as blooms, just as he had done 2 years ago when I first arrived at the Boston airport.
"Surprise," he said.
Jenna. The Elephant Sanctuary in Tennessee has a nice little downtown storefront with big pictures on the walls of all their animals, plus plaques that give the history of each elephant. It's weird seeing the names of the elephants that used to be at the New England Sanctuary. I pause the longest at the picture of Mora, the elephant my mother liked the most. I stare at it so hard that the image starts to blur. There is a table full of books you can buy, and Christmas ornaments, and bookmarks. There's a basket full of stuffed elephants. There's a looping video of a bunch of Asian elephants making sounds like a New Orleans swing band, and another of two elephants playing in a fire hose, just like city kids when the hydrants get turned on in the summer. Another smaller video player explains protected contact. Instead of using bull hooks or negative reinforcement, which is pretty much how the elephants had lived most of their lives, the sanctuary caregivers use positive reinforcement for training. There's always a barrier between the caregiver and the elephants, not just to give the caregiver safety, but to relax the animal, who can always walk away if she doesn't want to participate. It's been that way since 2010, and it's really helped, the video says, with elephants that have serious trust issues with humans as a result of free contact. Free contact. So that's what it's called when you can go right into an enclosure, like my mother and our caregivers used to do. I wonder if the death at our sanctuary and the debacle that followed led to the change. Only two other visitors are in the welcome center with me, both wearing fanny packs and Tevas with socks. We don't actually offer tours of the facility, an employee explains. Our whole philosophy is to let the elephants live out their lives being elephants instead of being on display. The tourists nod because it's the politically correct thing to do, but I can tell they're disappointed. Me? I'm on the prowl for a map. Downtown Hohenwald is no more than a single block, and there's no hint of the 2,700 acres of sweeping elephant vista anywhere nearby. Unless the animals are all shopping at the dollar store, I don't know where they're hiding out. I slip out the front door before the tourists do, and wander around back to the small employee parking lot. There are three cars and two pickup trucks. None have any logos on the doors for the elephant sanctuary. They could belong to just anyone. But I lean close to the passenger side windows of each car and peek inside to see if there's anything to identify the vehicle's owners. One belongs to a mom. There are sippy cups and Cheerios all over the floor. Two are owned by dudes. Fuzzy dice. Hunting catalogs. At the first pickup truck, though, I hit pay dirt. Flapping out of the driver's visor is a sheaf of papers, with the logo of the elephant sanctuary at the top. There's a messy cloud of hay in the back of the pickup, which is a good thing because it's so damn hot that bare metal would have practically branded me. I stow away in the flatbed, which is quickly becoming my favorite mode of transport. Less than an hour later, I'm bouncing down a road to a high metal gate with an electronic opening mechanism. The driver, a woman, punches in a code so that the gate opens. We drive about 100 feet before we hit a second gate, at which she does the same thing. As she drives, I try to get the lay of the land. The sanctuary is enclosed by a normal chain-link fence, but the interior corral is made of steel pipes and cable. I can't remember what our facility was like, but this one is pristine and orderly. Land stretches out forever. Hills and forests, ponds and grasslands, punctuated by several big barns. Everything is so green it makes my eyes hurt. When the truck pulls up to one of the barns, I flatten myself, hoping that I will not be seen as the driver gets out. I hear the door slam and footsteps, and then the happy trumpet of an elephant as this caregiver walks into the barn. I'm out of that truck like a rocket. I duck along the far wall of the barn, following the heavy cabled fence until I see my first elephant. It's African. I may not be an expert like my mom, but I know that much. I can't tell if it's a male or a female from this position, but it's freaking huge. Although maybe that's redundant when you're talking about elephants and you're only separated by 3 feet and some steel. Speaking of steel, there's metal on the elephant's tusks, sort of like they were dipped in gold at the tips. Suddenly, the elephant shakes its head, flapping its ears and releasing a cloud of reddish dust between us. It's loud and unexpected. I fall back, coughing.
"Who let you in?" a voice accuses.
I turn around to find a man towering over me. His hair is nearly shaved to his scalp. His skin is mahogany. His teeth are, by contrast, almost electroluminescent. I think he's going to grab me by my collar and drag me physically out of the sanctuary, or call the guards or whoever else keeps trespassers out of this place. But instead, his eyes get wide, and he stares at me as if I just apparated before him.
"You look just like her,"
he whispers. I had not expected it to be so easy to find Gideon. But then again, maybe after traveling 1,000 miles to get here, I deserved a cosmic break. "I'm Jenna."
"I know,"
Gideon says, looking around me.
"Where is she? Alice?"
Hope is a balloon, always just a breath away from being deflated. I was hoping she was here.
"You mean she didn't come with you?"
The disappointment on his face. Well, it is like I am looking into a mirror. "Then you don't know where she is," I say. My knees feel weak. I can't believe I've come all this way and have found him, and it's all for nothing.
"I tried to cover for her when the police came. I didn't know what happened out there, but Nevi was dead and Alice was missing. So I told the cops I assumed she had taken you and run off,"
he says.
"That was her plan all along."
All of a sudden, my body is infused with light. She wanted me. She wanted me. She wanted me. But somewhere between plotting her future and executing it, things had gone horribly wrong for my mother. Gideon, who was supposed to be the key to the lock, the antidote that would reveal the secret message, is just as clueless as I am. "Weren't you part of that plan?" He looks at me, trying to gauge how much I know about his relationship with my mother.
"I thought I was, but she never tried to contact me. She disappeared. Turned out I was a means to an end,"
Gideon admits.
"She loved me, but she loved you so much more."
I have forgotten where I am until that moment when the elephant in front of us lifts its trunk and trumpets. The sun is beating down on my scalp. I am dizzy, like I've been drifting in the ocean for days and just sent off my last flare, only to realize that the rescue boat I was so sure I saw was a trick of the light. The elephant with its fancy plated tusks makes me think of a merry-go-round horse I'd been scared of as a child. I don't even know when or where my parents might have taken me to a carnival, but those terrifying wooden stallions with their frozen manes and their gnashing teeth had made me cry. I feel like doing that now, too. Gideon keeps staring at me, and it's weird, like it's trying to see underneath my skin or riffle through the folds of my brain.
"I think there's someone you should meet,"
he says, and he starts walking the fence line. Maybe this has been a test. Maybe he needed to see that I was truly devastated before he would take me to my mother. I don't let myself hope, but as I follow him, I move faster and faster. What if? What if? What if? We walk for what feels like 30 miles in the ridiculous heat. My shirt is soaked through with sweat by the time we climb the hill, and I see, at its crest, another elephant. He doesn't have to tell me it's Mora. When she places her trunk delicately along the top edge of the fencing, the fingers opening and closing gently like the head of a rose. I know she remembers me the same way I remember her, at some internal, visceral level. My mother is really, truly not here. The elephant's eyes are dark and hooded, her ears translucent in the sun so that I can see the highway maps of veins running through them. Heat radiates from her skin. She looks leathery, primitive, cretaceous. The accordion folds of her trunk roll upward like a wave to reach over the fence toward me. She blows in my face, and it smells like summer and straw.
This is why I stayed, Gideon says. I thought one day Alice would come to check on Mora.
The elephant reaches out and curls her trunk around his forearm.
She had a really hard time when she first got here. Wouldn't leave the barn. She stayed in her stall, her face pressed into the corner.
I thought of the long entries in my mother's journals. You think she felt guilty about the trampling?
Maybe,
Gideon says.
Maybe it was fear of punishment. Or maybe she missed your mother, too.
The elephant rumbles like a car running its engine. The air around me vibrates. Mora picks up a pine log that is lying on its side. She scrapes her tusk along the edge of it, then lifts it with her trunk and presses it against the heavy steel fence. She scratches at the bark again, dropping the tree and rolling it beneath her foot. What is she doing?
Playing. We cut down trees for her so that she can strip off the bark.
After about 10 minutes, Mora lifts the log as if it is a toothpick and raises it as high as the fence.
Jenna!
Gideon cries.
Move!
He shoves me, landing on top of me, a few feet away from where the log has crashed down, exactly in the spot where I was standing. His hands are warm on my shoulders.
You all right?
He asks, helping me to my feet, and then he smiles.
The last time I held you, you were only 2 feet tall.
But I pull away from him to crouch down and stare at this gift I've been given. It's about 3 feet long by 10 inches wide, a hefty club. Mora's tusks have created patterns, lines that cross and grooves that intersect without rhyme or reason. Unless, that is, you're looking carefully. With my finger, I trace the lines. With a little imagination, I can make out a U and an S. That knot waves the wood grain like a W. On the other side of the log, a semicircle is caught in between two long scrapes. I-D-I. Sweetheart. Inkosa. Gideon may not think my mother ever came back, but I'm beginning to believe she's all around me. Just then my stomach grumbles so loud I sound like Mora.
You're starving, Gideon says.
I'm okay.
I'm getting you something to eat, he insists. I know that's what Alice would have wanted me to do.
Okay, I say, and we walk back to the barn I had first seen when I arrived in the pickup truck. His car is a big black van, and he has to move a box of tools from the passenger seat before I can sit down. As we are driving, I can feel Gideon still sneaking glances at me. It's like he's trying to memorize my face or something. That's when I realize that he's wearing the red shirt and cargo shorts that were the uniform at the New England Elephant Sanctuary. Everyone at the Elephant Sanctuary here in Hohenwald wears straight khaki. It doesn't make sense. How long did you say you've worked here?
Oh,
he says.
Years.
What are the odds that, in a sanctuary 2,700 acres large, I would run into Gideon first instead of any other person? Unless, of course, he made sure I did. What if I hadn't found Gideon Cartwright? What if he'd found me? I am thinking like Virgil, but that isn't necessarily a bad thing in terms of self-preservation. Sure, I'd set out all determined to find Gideon, but now that I have, I'm wondering if it was such a great idea. I can taste fear like a penny on my tongue. For the first time, it occurs to me that maybe Gideon had something to do with my mother's disappearance.
Do you remember that night?
He asks. It's like he pulled the thread out of my mind. I picture Gideon driving my mother away from the hospital, pulling over and wrapping his hands around her throat. I picture him doing the same thing to me. I force myself to keep my